Let's return to This Week in America. Here's your host, Rick Bratton.
Welcome back, everybody, coast to coast, This Week in America. Thank you for joining us on the program. Not to be believed, but it's 100% true. That's how one review describes the new book, Dynastic, Bombastic, Fantastic, Reggie Rowley Catfish and Charlie Finley's Swingin' A's by bestselling author Jason Turbo. The story of the Oakland A's of the 1970s, a revolutionary band of brawling Hall of Famers, winners of five straight division titles, three straight championships, knocking baseball into the modern age with their garish uniforms, outlandish facial hair, a turbulent yet magical time. Turbo captures the drama of one of the most unusual dynasties in baseball, the Oakland A's of the 1970s. Jason is the author of the bestseller The Baseball Codes, Beanball Sign-Stealing and Bench-Clearing Brawls, The Unwritten Rules of America's Pastime. He's written for The New York Times, The Wall Street Journal, SportsIllustrated.com, many more. And now, Dynastic, Bombastic, and Fantastic. Reggie, Rowley Catfish, and Charlie Finley Swingin' A's. And he's with us on This Week in America. Jason, welcome to the program. It's great to have you with us.
Hello, Rick. It's great to be on. Thank you for having me.
I am looking forward to this discussion, and the title is perfect. Dynastic, Bombastic, Fantastic. That really captures the essence of the 1970 A's, doesn't it?
It does. There was a lot going on in this clubhouse. The fact that they won three straight World Series, the only team other than the Yankees ever to do that, is the big picture selling item for this team. But the day-to-day accounts of the drama that went on in their clubhouse, the fist fights, the antagonism between the players and the front office, the antagonism between the players and each other makes for unbelievable drama. And it quickly occurred to me that even if this was a last place team, it would be a story worth telling.
You know, it's interesting because you mentioned all the success on the field, and as a baseball fan, you sort of forget that because you get caught up in Charlie Finley, Vita Blue, Mike Andrews, that we'll talk about, Dick Williams, Reggie Jackson, all of the players on the team and all of the issues they went through, not only with each other, but with Charlie Finley. Let's first of all talk about how the A's ended up out in Oakland. An interesting story. Charlie Finley moved the team out there from Kansas City.
Yeah, he purchased the team in 1961. It was located in Kansas City at the time. And he made promises to the civic leaders in Missouri that he intended to move himself out there from his insurance headquarters in Chicago, and he'd move his family out there. He never did that. And in fact, he never stopped trying to move the team out of Kansas City. As soon as he bought it, rumors surfaced with cities like Louisville and New Orleans and Milwaukee and Seattle. And he quickly burns some bridges in Kansas City. He couldn't wait to get out. Eventually, he decided upon Oakland. You know, as soon as he got approval from Major League Baseball, Oakland had a brand new 50,000-seat Coliseum. I think that was very attractive to him. I think another factor that was attractive was the fact that everyone in baseball told him it couldn't be done, that the Bay Area was not a two-team market.
Yes.
The Giants were already here, and there was no way there was enough audience for two big league teams. Finley actually hired a search company and then ordered them to tell me to move to Oakland. So he did it, and it turns out everyone in baseball was right. He never sold tickets, even as the team started to win championships.
Yeah, it's interesting. When he brings the team in and he's saying, here's the conclusion I want, go ahead and put this together, the team of the people that are going to do the research to find out whether or not they could support two teams. Here's the conclusion I want. You go ahead and put the facts together that we'll get to this conclusion. And because of that, he was never accepted there. And you talk in the book of the fact that they had Oakland on their jersey, and then it was just A's on the jersey. Like, they're ready for a move. They can move tomorrow and fit in with another city.
They could. Well, I mean, the big factor, the big dividing line between Finley and the crowd of Oaklandites he wanted to attract was the fact that he never became part of society there. You know, just like he promised in Kansas City, he promised to move to Oakland, and he promised to move his family to Oakland. He never left Chicago. His insurance headquarters were in Chicago. He stayed there. He visited Oakland a couple times a year. He caught the A's when they visited the White Sox. But he was never part of the fabric of society in Northern California. He was never interested in it, and he never made any efforts to get his team involved on the executive level. So the fans never embraced him. And it's easy to look for a comparison at the team that shared the A's home ballpark, the Oakland Coliseum. When it came to the Oakland Raiders, their owner, Al Davis, was all about the East Bay. He was ingrained in all sorts of civic activities, and the Raiders fans could not get enough of him. He sold them out. He fostered the greatest fans in football, and Finley never had a chance of replicating that.
We're talking with Jason Turbo, author of the book Dynastic, Bombastic, Fantastic, Reggie Rodley Catfish, and Charlie Finley's Swingin' A's. The book is available all across the country. Information, of course, if you go to our website, thisweekinamerica.us, and you can link on and get direct information on the book. Let's talk about the cast of characters he put together. He's there for a couple of years, and suddenly he's on the verge of building this dynasty. How did he go about putting this team together?
Finley was a smart guy, and he was a self-made multimillionaire. He built up an insurance business from scratch, and he was a fantastic salesman. That's how he did it. And when he bought a baseball team, he was smart enough to know that he was not a talent evaluator. He couldn't look at a guy and tell you if he was good or bad or projected well. But he was able to get on the phone and talk to fellow executives and scouts across the league and other front office types, and just gather information incessantly. Finley spent hours every day on the phone. And, you know, it was in the guise of trade talks frequently. Sometimes it was in the guise of job interviews. But he would collect opinions and scouting reports on his own players on other teams, on unrelated players to whatever talks he was in. And when he heard something repeated often enough, he took note, and he used that information to build an incredible dynasty.
And this was in the era before free agency, so you had to go about building a team differently then, didn't you?
Oh, yeah. This was in the era, in the beginning, it was in the era before the amateur player draft, meaning that teams could go in and sign whichever players they wanted as frequently as they wanted. That actually worked very much to Finley's advantage because his insurance business was booming. This was in the mid-1960s. He needed to offset some tax income, and he spent a ton of money on player acquisition. That shifted once he had his players into player development, and as his insurance business started making less and less money because he was devoting more and more attention to his baseball team, that all kind of went away. But it didn't matter at that point because he had the players in place.
As you read the book Dynastic, Bombastic, Fantastic, Reggie Rolick, Catfish, and Charlie Finley's Swingin' A's by Jason Turbo, our guest on the program, what Charlie Finley, I guess complicated is maybe the best word to describe him. I mean, there are areas where it's like, this guy's a genius, and then a couple paragraphs down, it's like, God, this guy's a jerk.
Well, yeah, people can be geniuses and jerks at the same time.
Well, exactly.
Yeah, complicated is a great word. He did amazing things for his players, especially early on. He would invest their money for them. I mean, he would take whatever part of their salary they wanted. He would invest it in the stock market. He was a great and canny stock picker, and they'd earn a lot of money. But his offer was unbeatable because he would give them their entire investment back, even if the stocks tanked.
Yeah, so it was guaranteed.
Players definitely appreciate that.
Yeah, it was guaranteed. It's like, this is what I'm going to do, or you get your money back.
Yeah, I mean, who makes that kind of offer, right? So that's one side of the guy's personality. You know, he gave them full size replica trophies after they won their first World Series. He gave them outrageously expensive championship rings. The other side of the guy's personality was when it came time to negotiate contracts, he wasn't having any of it. I mean, guys could hem and haw, but he didn't budge very much. Like you said, this was in the era before free agency for the most part. Players didn't have any say in how much they got made or what teams they got to play for. They were controlled by their franchise until their franchise decided otherwise. Finley dictated terms, and that's how he succeeded. People could make suggestions, but the guy was an egomaniac. He was almost completely devoid of the ability to delegate. And so he was his own general manager. Who does that in baseball? And he shortchanged these guys on their contracts left, right, and center. And over time, they built up a lot of resentment for it, to the point where he didn't care if he was shooting himself in the foot. If players were holding out, notably Vida Blue in 1972, It didn't matter to Finley. All he wanted was to be right. And when he felt he had the moral high ground in a situation, if he felt the contract offer he made was fair, he wasn't going to be budged from that spot. And in 1972, that cost him the services of the biggest drawing card in baseball.
You know, it's interesting because the ramifications it has on all of the team. And let's jump ahead to 1973. I mentioned Mike Andrews before in the beginning of the program. Let's talk about him, because here's a real case where Finley does something and there are really serious repercussions. In fact, ended up probably costing him his manager. Talk about that. It's the World Series in 1973. Mike Andrews goes into the game as a pitch hitter, stays in the game to field, and the results are not what they wanted.
No. Well, Mike Andrews was a second baseman who had been released by Chicago midseason. Formerly, you know, all-star caliber player, but at this point in his career, he was older. He'd had some arm injuries. He was not a competent fielder. Everybody knew it when they signed him. They signed him to be exclusively a right-handed pinch hitter. Yet somehow they're in extra innings in Game 2 against the New York Mets in the 1973 World Series. Andrews finds himself in the field against his own better judgment, makes a couple of costly errors. The A's lose. And Finley's response was to think, I need to get this guy off my roster. He wanted to call up minor league second baseman Manny Trio, who was a capable fielder, but you know, once you lock your World Series rosters, they're locked.
Yes.
Except in case of injury replacement. So Finley concocted this idea wherein he would have his doctor examine Andrews, decree he was too injured to play, and then he would be able to replace him with this youngster like he wanted. Problem was, Andrews wasn't injured. At least he wasn't injured any more than he was the day they signed him. Finley strong-armed him into signing this note from the doctor and tried to ram it through baseball to get his way. While Andrews was being examined, the team was on their bus, ready to go to the airport, and they weren't moving for reasons none of them really understood. They knew something was going on with Andrews. They worked themselves up into a lather right there on the bus, like chanting, "We want Mike! We want Mike!" Andrews never showed up. Eventually, the bus went to the airport without him. The team flew to New York for 5 hours talking about what was going on, and they all quickly came to the realization that if Finley could fire Mike Andrews for making errors during a World Series, he could fire any of them. And the outrage was palpable. Like, this is not something you do to a guy, to a ball player on any level, let alone during the World Series. They got to New York for the workout day the next day. They taped Andrews' number 17 to their sleeves in athletic tape, and reporters couldn't get enough of it. I mean, we're talking about the media capital of the country on the sport's biggest stage. These players ripped Finley up and down. They were merciless. I mean, they were accurate, but they were merciless. And that's where it turned for Finley. All these nice things he had done previously, he stopped doing from that point on and never picked up again. He held that against them forever. What eventually happened was the commissioner of baseball, Bowie Kuhn, ordered him to reinstate Andrews. So Andrews showed up for Game 4. Finley instructed his manager, Dick Williams, very clearly, I do not want to see this guy anywhere near the field. Williams responded by sending Andrews up to pinch hit at his earliest available opportunity. And the fans at Shea Stadium, God bless them, knew exactly what was going on. They gave Andrews a standing ovation. I mean, less because they liked Mike Andrews than because they didn't like Charlie Finley.
Yes.
And that was the last at-bat Andrews ever had. And Williams was so fed up by the entire affair, in addition to a number of other things that had led up to it, that his way of celebrating, as champagne flew around him in the victorious clubhouse, was to quit on the spot.
Yeah, and here's an incident where the entire team turns against him. You can sort of see the tide turning at that particular point in time. And you mentioned Bowie Kuhn. This really was sort of a classic battle between the commissioner and the owner, wasn't it? I mean, this went on. You pick up the newspaper just about every week. There was a story about the two of them fighting over something.
Oh, it was, for sure. I mean, Finley was as hard-headed as it gets, and Kuhn wasn't too far behind. And you know, like I say, Finley just wanted to be right all the time, and he was never liked among baseball's ownership ranks because he was an idea machine. Like, he had great ideas. You know, he was the driving force behind implementation of the designated hitter. He got them to start weekday World Series games at night, so you know the working man could better tune in. He had bad ideas. He wanted orange baseballs. He wanted three ball walks. Regardless, he had tons of ideas, and baseball doesn't really work that way. It's constantly behind the times. It's known for its anachronism. So fellow owners bristled at Finley, and not only his big mouth, but his insistence on getting his way. Kuhn was right there with him. He really didn't like Finley at all, and Finley liked Kuhn even less than Kuhn liked Finley.
You know, it's interesting. We're talking about dynastic, bombastic, fantastic. Reggie Rolick, Catfish, and Charlie Finley's Swingin' Age. Jason Turbo, bestselling author, the author of this book, with us on This Week in America. Despite the fact that all the success, the team really never caught on, and then free agency came in, and things really fell apart. Talk about that. You mentioned the Vita Blue situation a couple of years before that. Catfish Hunter goes, then Reggie goes. It really fell apart then, with literally within a couple of years, the dynasty's over.
Yeah, well, Finley was a guy who operated really well in the framework and that gave him all the power. When he dictated every last detail of his team, it worked. I mean, the guy was his own general manager. He mandated the ballpark organist playlist. Like, his fingers were in every pot in that ballpark. and he would stomp down any player who questioned him. So, like I said, Vita Blue held out for more money after winning the MVP and Cy Young Awards in 1971. Finley was having none of it. He made what he felt was a fair contract offer and wasn't willing to tolerate anything else. That was the kind of guy he was. So when free agency came around, he didn't know how to adapt. Like, suddenly, for the first time in baseball history, players have a say in their own future. They get a pick if they're going to stay with a team or maybe go to a different team. They also knew for the first time how much other players on other teams were getting paid. And that came as a bit of a shock to the Oakland A's, who were three-time defending champions and somehow had one of the lowest payrolls in the league. So when these guys had a chance to leave, there was a group known as the Oakland Seven. Seven guys who had a chance to bolt town at the end of the season, unless Finley offered them contracts that they signed. They all put multi-year offers on his desk at the beginning of the year. Finley not only, he didn't even turn them down. He didn't even respond to them. By the time the season was well underway, he realized, holy cow, I got to lock these guys up. He tried to reanimate those offers, but by that point, those seven guys wanted nothing to do with him. They didn't sign, and he lost all of them. His franchise crumbled virtually overnight. It's worth noting that across the country, a guy who knew how to play that very game in much better ways, George Steinbrenner, the owner of the Yankees, in short order won two straight championships with Charlie Finley's two best players, Reggie Jackson and Catfish Hunter.
You know, it's interesting when you mentioned Reggie Jackson. You opened the book talking about a meeting the two had. Reggie Jackson had just been sold to Baltimore. I think it was in 1976. They're playing in Chicago. And Finley, and of course he's got his insurance business based in Chicago, calls Reggie and has him come over, and he owed Reggie some money, which Reggie, I guess, had forgotten about. And they're sitting there talking. And you say that Charlie Finley basically had always been sort of a lonely man, but it's like he was just beginning maybe to realize that. Was it, with all the success that he had, was he a lonely man?
Well, yeah, it really seemed to me that was the case. He was vivacious. I mean, it wasn't like he was locked in a room,
right,
hoping for company. The guy was, you know, he made a habit of taking friends out to dinner and propping up a speakerphone in the middle of the restaurant table, and where he would pipe in A's games from Oakland. And then he'd say, watch this. He'd pick up the phone, call the dugout in Oakland, order a move to be made, and then they'd all sit and listen to that move being made in real time on the radio. So he had lots of, you know, associates and hangers-on, but when it came to people who were really close to him, especially within the game, there weren't any there. I mean, when Finley died, the only two guys who went to his funeral from baseball were Catfish Hunter and Reggie Jackson, guys he had tons and tons of issues with. He was not one for making friends unless the terms of the friendship were his own.
Some people will say this is maybe the most transformational team in the history of baseball. It happened over a relatively short period of time, but it'd be pretty hard to argue against that, wouldn't it? I mean, they basically redid baseball at that time.
Oh, yeah, I think that's absolutely correct. This team pulled baseball from the sport we picture in the late 1950s right on into the sport we picture in the late 1970s. Finley was responsible for wild colors in uniforms. I mean, before he bought the A's in Kansas City, baseball was a game of home whites and road grays. You know, and Finley gave many monologues about how you know, once upon a time, all cars used to be black. But then people realized they liked colors. And now look at the highway. Cars are all different colors. He wanted the same thing for baseball. You know, it's one of his many, many ideas to promote the game. The A's brought back facial hair. for the first time in more than a half century. There had been an informal ban on any sort of facial hair. One day, Reggie Jackson shows up with a beard in spring training. His teammates hate it. They can't get him to shave it. So they decide the way we'll get him to shave is if we grow our own mustaches. Finley will see us all. He'll order everybody to shave in a blanket rebuke, and then we'll all move on our way. Well, because it's Charlie Finley, he saw their faces and was thunderstruck. Here's a promotional opportunity. So he decreed that June 18th would be Mustache Day. Anybody on the team who had a mustache by that date, which happened to be the date of the team picture, would get a $300 bonus. To which pitcher Ken Holtzman responded, "For $300, I will grow hair on my feet." It was a ballpark promotion. Fans who showed up with mustaches, got discounted tickets, and it turned into a big thing. And suddenly, the A's are the not only the shaggiest bunch in baseball, but really the only shaggy bunch. The 1972 World Series against the clean-cut Cincinnati Reds became known as the Hairs versus the Squares.
I can remember that well, and the contrast between the two teams. We're talking about the new book, Dynastic, Bombastic, Fantastic, Reggie Roley, Can't Fish, and Charlie Finley's Swingin' A's with the author Jason Turbo. A couple minutes left in the program. You really were able to talk to a number of people in putting this together. Some of the ball players are not with us now, but you talked to a number of not only ball players, but front office people, journalists, that type of thing. You really got a good view of what that team was like, didn't you?
Oh, I did. I mean, I tried to go in with no preconceived notions other than the fact that this was a great team. And people cast such sharp opinions on what was going on. I mean, they all remember dealing with Charlie Finley very clearly. And at times I worried, oh my God, am I coming down too harshly on Finley in this narrative? But it's all representative of the things I heard and the things I read from the time. And the other part is that, this team is undersold. For one of the greatest teams in history,
yes.
It's hard to find recognition that they so much as existed in many circles. And I think a lot of these players understood that talking to me might in some way help alter that fact. There were guys like Reggie are above it, but the role players, even the stars who are not in the Hall of Fame, their identities are wrapped up in this team. Sal Bando was a great player, but he's known primarily as the third baseman and captain of the A's. And so it's getting this book out there might somehow correct that oversight, correct the record of that this team is just undersold in the pantheon of baseball. And I think that led a lot of guys to really open up very, very nicely to me.
In the book, you've got the cast of characters, and as you're looking through that, you're right, with the names that are in the title that we know, Reggie, Roley, Catfish. You've got Dave Duncan, Ray Fosse, Billy North, Blue Moon Odom, who said he had to be nuts to play on this team and said basically they give you a test, and if you fail it, you get on the team. Vita Blue that we had mentioned, Bert Campanaris. I mean, this really was a talented group of baseball players.
It was. And to Charlie Finley's credit, he was a wheeler dealer. As his own GM, he made something like 67 trades in 1972 alone, to the point where Dick Williams, his manager, said his best source of information to know who was on his roster at any given moment was to walk in the door and see who showed up. But Finley never touched his core. He left those guys alone, and they're the ones who won him championships. Everyone else was just a supporting figure.
It is a fascinating book. And before we go, how can we follow you on Twitter?
I am at Dynastic Book, tweeting a day-by-day account of all three championship seasons. So lots of clubhouse drama for which I didn't have space in the final product is working its way in there.
Well, it's interesting. If they weren't fighting the front office, they were fighting each other in the clubhouse. You can get all the story in the book, Dynastic, Bombastic, Fantastic. Reggie Roley, Catfish, and Charlie Finley, Swingin' A's, best-selling author Jason Turbo, with us on the program. Jason, loved reading the book. Thank you so much for being with us on the program.
Great talking to you, Rick. Thank you for having me on.
You're welcome. You're listening to This Week in America, website thisweekinamerica.us.
You're listening to This Week in America with Rick Bratton. More after this.